This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Our sole guest this evening is the 19th governor of Arizona, Fife Symington. Normally we say welcome, but I'd like to say happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. Somebody ratted me out, huh?
Wikipedia. It's amazing what you can find there. Milestone birthday at that.
Yeah, it really is. Somebody said, "Hi, what are you doing on your birthday?" I said, "I'm hiding."
Yeah, well, actually, that maybe is a good occasion to be reflective about your life and history. I think one of the things that would surprise people is the kind of an interesting collection of people who you have encountered in the course of your life. And one of the most incongruous is a fellow by the name of John Waters. Who is John Waters?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Johnny and I were classmates in grade school together in Maryland called Calvert. And I think he kind of liked the school. I didn't. It was really tough. And he then subsequently became a great playwright and author and of course Hairspray. Everybody's been to Hairspray, and that was his
Hairspray, Pink Flamingo, stuff that tended to what I would call the weird.
Yeah, and I'd like to think that I was kind of at the early age of 7 or 8 or 9, whatever our ages were at that time when Johnny and I were playing and best of friends, that I was there at the genesis of all that, because he had a puppet show, which was really very dramatic. And I was his assistant puppeteer, and we used to go around and charge money and put this puppet show on. And I think that Hairspray probably came from all of that.
So you were the business end of the deal, were you?
No, I was just a very loyal assistant.
Very, very, very incongruous. I mean, for anybody who doesn't have the mental limits, John Waters, a fellow with a famous pencil mustache, and basically does very avant-garde kind of stuff. Kind of the, and you have a sort of blue blood button-down image. It's just an incongruity to me.
Yeah, well, I think people have always sort of presumed what you just said, but really I've got a very diverse group of friends, and I'm not as buttoned down as you might think. And Johnny and I were great friends. We had a lot of fun together, and he was eccentric and funny, and just actually created a few problems along the way. We had some parents that really got mad at us, especially for his Halloween Hall of Horrors that he had in his garage. It just scared some kids to death, and we had to shut it down.
So another incongruity, an early connection that would surprise a lot of people who haven't heard the story, at least, Bill Clinton.
Well, that's kind of worked both ways for me politically, I guess.
I assume
as a Republican.
In Republican meetings, it probably doesn't win you any accolades. Yeah.
Well, the story basically is that my best friend is probably his best friend, Tom Kaplan, who's a novelist and from Baltimore. And Tommy and I were roommates together at Gilman, classmates and roommates together. And then when we all separated, went to college, he went to Georgetown, I went to Harvard. And it turned out that his roommate was just serendipity, because it was just sort of luck of the draw. One of his roommates was Bill Clinton. And so during our college years, we all got together periodically and had some fun. And then we had a weekend beach party up at Hyannisport. I may well have been my junior year at Harvard. My memory's a little dull. And he was there. And my mission was to protect my first cousins. I had two first cousins, Jane and Elise, who were just beautiful, wonderful people. And I was escorting them. I was their male version of a Spanish dueña that weekend, trying to protect them from Bill all weekend.
The rest of the story, though, tell us about the swimming incident.
Well, everybody was partying, and it wasn't a big group. And Tommy and I and Elise and Jane were walking down the beach, and Tommy turned to me, and it was a windy day, and there were severe currents, and the red flags were up. Tommy looked at me, he says, "Where's Bill?" And we're kind of looking around, and there, way out offshore, was Bill Clinton, caught in a riptide, headed to Portugal. I mean, you know, it was severe riptide. And so there just happened to be this little tiny dory on the beach with the oars and the oarlocks. rocks in it, which was really a miracle. And I sprinted down there and got the boat and went out, and about 400 yards offshore, it was quite a ways out, I intercepted him on his ride. And in those days, he had shoulder-length hair and was a fairly big guy. So I got sort of upstream of him because the current's pretty severe, and I grabbed him by his hair and I kind of lifted him up and I said, "Would you like a ride?" And I struggled and flipped him into the boat. And he was sputtering and gagging and had lacerated his chest because he'd been dragged over some rocks in the very beginning. And so that was it until years later. I'd totally forgotten the incident.
It was probably more memorable to him than it was to you.
Yeah, it really was. I just went out and saved him, and which was the right thing to do, I think. And, we didn't really, we stayed in touch over the years as he ran for office in Arkansas and I ran for governor and won. And we were rejoined at the National Governors Conference in Seattle in 91.
So you had no contact in the intervening years?
Well, no, we'd stayed in touch, and especially through Tommy, but not really close touch, mm-hmm. but yeah, we were friends. Mm-hmm. And during this Governors Conference, Chelsea ended up befriending Whitney, my daughter Whitney.
And so they were probably both very small at the time.
Yeah, they were. And Chelsea spent the night with us. And then Bill and Hillary came up to our place, our hotel room, the next day to pick him up. And Bill had never met Ann, and he gave her a great big hug. And he says, "Did Fife ever tell you the story how he saved my life?" And that I had totally forgotten it. I never talked about it or anything, especially during my political campaign. And So that's kind of where it started again. And of course, he at the time had decided to run for governor, run for president. Well, he hadn't quite yet, but he was working the room. He was shaking hands with all the governors, and I watched him walk around, and he got to me, and I looked at him. I said, "You're running for president, aren't you?" "Oh, well, maybe I am. I don't know." I said, "Yeah, you're running for president. I know you are.
You do a decent Arkansas."
Yeah. Well, I've been around him enough to do it. And so then everything was great and peaceful and calm. I was a new governor. I get back to Arizona, and Paul Harvey blew the lid off the whole deal with the rest of the story, talking about the two governors and who were childhood friends and how I'd saved his life. And he did, you know, his classic, the rest of the story. So
that was a perfect story for that.
Well, the cat was let out of the bag. And I can promise you, after that, just about every Republican audience I went to, somebody would ask that question. And before the question was done and before I even answered, there'd be booing in the audience. And so I would always just smile and I'd say, "Well, they, you know, why did you save Bill Clinton?" You know, and mm-hmm. I said, "Well, it was the Christian thing to do."
Good answer for Republican audience. One more quick one, probably less significant encounter, but I understand you in your early years, you actually literally butted heads with Al Gore.
Yeah. It turned out that I didn't know this until I met his best friend here in Arizona, Gary Goodman, who was the quarterback of the St. Albans football team, who were our big rivals in our football league. And I didn't realize it, but Al Gore was his center. And my job as defensive linebacker was to knock the center in the head on every play and soften him up and penetrate the backfield, and also to get Goodman. And apparently I did a pretty good job of that. We won the game. And
you think you got the best of him? That was my last follow-up question.
No, he got the best of me, because one day I was in the Oval Office with the president, President Clinton, working on NAFTA, and it was me as chief of staff. And we were talking, and this big hand grabbed my shoulder and spun me around, and it was the vice president. It was Gore. And he said, "So you're Symington. You're the guy who kneed me in the head in that whole ball game, you know?" And and Gore's a big guy. And I said, "Yeah, Mr. Vice President, I guess there's no time like the present to apologize."
And he was on home turf. We will be back with Governor Fife Symington and more stories in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Governor Fife Symington, reminiscing about your early life. You encountered another public figure, an Arizonan, Barry Goldwater, at a relatively early age.
Yeah, he and my father were friends, and my dad had run for Congress in 58, I guess, Dad had always been a supporter of Goldwaters, and I was probably 10 years old, 10 or 11 years old. And I'll never forget the senator from Arizona arrived at our farm in Maryland driving a Corvette Stingray, I think it was, and he had his cowboy hat on and his boots on. And when he kind of walked through the front door, it was just kind of one of those moments. I mean, for a young kid, very impressionable.
You're 10 or 12. That's pretty cool.
It made a big impression. It really did. And it was in the winter. It was kind of cold. So I remember we were in my father's library and fire in the fireplace, and he and the senator were sitting on the couch. I was on the floor, and they were discussing the evil empire of the Soviet Union and, you know, peace through strength. And they were talking about all kinds of international issues. And I remember it well. It was really a great experience.
Now, I remember reading as well about Eisenhower and Nixon around the same time plotting against Goldwater while officially supporting him.
Yeah, well, we had my mother was quite a devoted Republican, and she and Dad put this big affair on for Goldwater for president, and Nixon was to be the speaker. And he out at the farm, and we had an elephant there and everything. It was really hilarious. So my mother turned to me and said, where's Nixon? Because he had disappeared. And so we had this old country house, and we kind of wandered through the rooms and everything. And we came up to the library where I spent time with my dad in Goldwater. And there was Milton Eisenhower, who was the president of Hopkins, and the president's brother, Dr. Milton Eisenhower, and Richard Nixon, who was out of office at the time, but obviously making a comeback.
And you're talking early 62 thereabouts, right?
Well, this was leading up to the 64 election, mm-hmm. Right. And my mother listened before she went in, and they were conspiring to throw William Scranton's name, who was the governor of Pennsylvania, his name into the ring in the Maryland convention. So here is Nixon coming to support
and
Goldwater.
He was more the modern Eastern establishment wing of the Republican Party.
That's right. Yeah. So Nixon was playing both sides. And so my mother, who had quite a temper, it was definitely time to head to the bomb shelter when she lost her temper, burst into the room and interrupted the meeting. And first she addressed Milton Eisenhower, and she says, "Milton Eisenhower, you leave the farm immediately. You are not welcome here. This is a Goldwater event. I don't ever want to see your face again. You leave."
Wow.
So she kicked Milton Eisenhower off the farm. Okay. Then she turned on Nixon and she says, "And as for you, Dick Nixon, you should know better. Get out there and give the Goldwater speech you're supposed to give." And Nixon was looking very contrite. And so the three of us, I'm Nixon, my mother, and out we go, and out to the porch, and Nixon changes his colors and gives a great Goldwater speech.
Your mother must have been a very powerful woman.
She was really something. You did not want to cross my mother.
You know, what I also find fascinating about that is I don't ever recall having read anything much about Eisenhower and Nixon having much to do one another post-Eisenhower's presidency.
Well, now, this was Milton Eisenhower.
Oh, okay.
Not the president.
Okay.
This was the president's brother.
Okay.
And he was a Marylander and head of Hopkins. And somehow, I guess he and Nixon, knew each other.
Sure.
And so that was the connection. And the Eastern liberal establishment, they used to call it, was trying to get Scranton to go. And of course, he did enter the Maryland. He did enter the race for the presidency from Maryland. The Maryland convention was his first outing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I'm told you didn't think much of Harvard.
Well, Harvard was in total turmoil when I got there. I mean, I came from a fairly peaceful school in Maryland, which had a fairly diverse student body. And all of a sudden, I found myself at a large university, which was in a state of chaos because of the Vietnam War.
Uh-huh. And you were, I love this, as a believer in the liberal arts, your concentration was Dutch art history.
17th century Dutch painting. Yeah.
This is the sort of thing that a lot of parents would just go ballistic over in terms of the practicality thereof.
Well, that's the purpose of the liberal arts, is to kind of give you a really diverse view of the world and a broader understanding of history. And of course, art history is just another way of studying history. Mm-hmm. And I was always intrigued by the Holland in the 17th century because they threw off the yoke of Spanish tyranny. The Mad Duke of Alba, who killed, I think, something like 17,000 Protestants in the lowlands in that era. And so once they threw that that burden off, this tremendous art just proliferated. And it's one of the greatest periods in art history, I think.
Well, you'll find no argument here, but boy, liberal art sure takes an awful hit in public discourse. Moving forward, Vietnam era, you served in Thailand. What did you actually do?
I was a weapons controller.
What does that mean?
That means basically it's like an air traffic controller, FAA air traffic controller, but it's augmented by the fact that you're in a combat environment so that the pilots that you're working with, you're protecting from sneak MiG attacks. And so a lot of aerial combat. And then when the pilots inevitably got shot down, you would move into the role of a SAR commander and try to get them out of the jungle where they were shot down, that type of activity.
Mm-hmm. So there were flights that were actually leaving from Thailand and you
Yeah, the major, the war in Laos was to interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which came through Laos, and then it worked its way down into Vietnam. And our job was to basically fight the air battle over Laos.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with Governor Fife Symington and more stories and a little bit more Arizona history.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here with Governor Fife Symington reminiscing on his life and history. I want to fast forward a little bit to your time as governor. And I'm sort of connecting the dots between a couple of things. I know in reading your bio that you had a very positive experience in secondary school and a private school. I'm wondering if your affection for charter schools in any way came from that.
I think it did. I experienced the value of a really great private education. I mean, the school that I went to was really tough. I mean, we'd get home in the evening and hit the books and have maybe an hour's break for dinner. And then I remember studying, trying to keep up till 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. And did that. And that started at the age of 12 or 13. I mean, they just threw it. Gilman threw it at us. And so, frankly, that high school experience was much more difficult than college. I mean, college was a breeze. It was easy because we were so well prepared. I mean, I took advanced placement exams in both English and history and was advanced placement going into Harvard. So that means I could take upper level courses right away. And the training I got at Gilman was just superb.
I remember having a lot the same experience, having suffered through a Catholic school. The level of discipline.
Yeah.
I didn't encounter anything. And I went to a public high school in between. It was sort of like taking 3 years off from work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had seven roommates my freshman year at Mass Hall at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them came from the public school background. And they really struggled in the beginning. Of course, they all caught up by sophomore year or whatever, but the freshman year was quite a readjustment for a lot of them. It's just the undisciplined environment that you were in called for a great deal of discipline and in terms of devotion to your studies. And
I remember having exactly that same experience at Brown, coming out the last 3 years in a public high school and sitting in a political science course and when going to a discussion section and mm-hmm. I'm prepared to regurgitate the book. And I go into this session and all the prep school kids sat there ripping the thing apart. And I'm just sort of dumbfounded. I said, I came here to recite back what I'd learned. And they'd taken it a step further. And it sort of took me a semester or so to figure out, okay, there's another level at which you can experience what you read.
Yeah.
And in a public school had never been asked to do that.
Well, I think public schools are just great public schools here in Arizona. But it's... I just often thought that competition is the American way, and you improve through competition. And so, the most effective way to improve public education
is to create competition.
And it was just that simple. That was kind of what I held in my heart, why I did what I did.
I want to ask you about, there's just a human side of it. You were tried for bank fraud conviction. The conviction is reversed on appeal. But the human side aspect of that, I remember reading that when that this was under appeal, you were in a situation where you were in effect on 24-hour notice. If the thing took a wrong legal turn, you could have been packed off to prison on 24 hours notice.
Right. I had a duffel bag, and I'll never forget. It was a yellow duffel bag, and it was in my dressing room, and it was packed and ready to go. And you know, had it not been for the Ninth Circuit basically doing the right thing, I would have been up at Nellis, but I would have been cooking, which would have been a good thing.
I want to ask about just your mental state in that. If you know that this has this huge cloud hanging over your head, mm-hmm. you know, if that was something that could happen with relatively no notice, I mean, how do you deal with that emotionally and mentally?
Well, you have to, you know, as a family, we talked about it, and we were all very open about it. We knew that was a strong possibility. And you just have to live day by day and take it as it comes and cherish your freedom every day, and because your liberty is threatened at any moment. And I thought never in my life would I ever be in this kind of position.
I assume this is the most this is not something
no,
that occurs to you.
It was an otherworldly experience. I mean, it was just totally unbelievable. But we handled it, and of course, I had just an inherent deep confidence that I'd win the appeal, that I hadn't been treated fairly, that the whole thing was just totally wrong, and I held on to that. It was kind of like being a political prisoner, in mm-hmm. effect. You know, I had maybe it's that Scottish rebellious gene mm-hmm. in me, but I wasn't going to take it, and I really felt that I would prevail in the end, and it turned out that was the case.
Have you ever seen the Netflix series Orange is the New Black?
I haven't, but I watch it.
I mean, yeah. Well, the thing about it is it's essentially middle-class woman who ends up in prison, mm-hmm. and it's about the misfit between her and the people yeah. around her.
Well, I kept myself really busy, which I think is one of the keys to getting through a really dire period like that. Mm-hmm. And so I was in culinary school, and I was working really hard. I wasn't just lying around sort of waiting for the gong to sound. Uh-huh. And the whole culinary experience really sort of took me away, made me apply myself in a different way. And I think that was very, very therapeutic. And then Terry Stewart, who was the director of the prison system in Arizona, was a great friend. And I called him up one day and I said, you know, Terry, if they send me to Nellis, I said, I want you to call those guys up there and tell them, you know, I'll behave myself, but I want to be put in the kitchen because I've got culinary skills to use.
was that a motivation or was that a prior interest, the cooking?
Well, you know, it's something that's always interested me, but I'd never really taken it seriously. Mm-hmm. So I was prepared to go, but I was also told that I'd be put in the kitchen, which would have been great.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically, it's short-term career planning.
Yeah.
You think it was essentially a political prosecution?
Yes.
And if so, by whom?
Well, I Janet Reno just hated my guts. If you'll remember, when I became governor, I was very strong on the 10th Amendment. And at the time, our state prison system had a special monitor. The feds were just in where they didn't belong. So I basically took them on. I took the Justice Department on many fronts, and we won. I don't know if you remember this or not, but we won at the Supreme Court. We won our case, and they were kicked out of our state prison system. And
10th Amendment, in case anybody missed it, is essentially states' rights.
Yeah.
Power is not otherwise identified.
So I was probably seen as a rising political star, and I was really messing with the Justice Department and beating them, and we'd be back in Washington. And I was in a meeting with her one day when she was yelling and screaming at me. I mean, you know, and even the Clintons didn't like her. You know, she wasn't their first choice for attorney general. So they had limited control over her. And so there was sort of no mercy. And I think if you look in enough detail in anybody's financial life that's involved in business and stuff, you can find something that is technically wrong or whatever and make a big deal about it. But I think the intensity of the effort to take me down speaks volumes as to the political nature of it.
Given that experience, can you think of any other recent prosecutions that you think have been essentially political?
It's not really. Let me just digress. You know, this whole business with Hillary right now, mm-hmm. and the emails and the mm-hmm. bloodlust that you're seeing in the press. And I'm a Republican, and I don't intend to vote for Hillary. But I'll tell you one thing. This whole experience I've been through, people have no idea what it's like to be threatened, to have your liberty threatened.
An entirely different level.
To have the FBI and the Justice Department basically lay you out completely and do a life audit on you, what you did every minute of the day for 20 years of your life.
With unlimited resources.
Yeah, you know, and so when I see people making harsh comments about, oh, yeah, we're finally going to get Hillary, stuff like that, I don't belong to that crowd anymore, because I've been there just as a human being. I know how terrible that process is on the individual and their family, and you don't want to wish it on anybody. And I think justice has become very political in this country, and it's going to undermine the strength of the justice system, the legitimacy of it in the eyes of the normal citizen. I think that's happening.
I mean, I think of the case of Bill Clinton. It seemed like every other prosecution that you ever seen started with a crime and looked for a whodunit. Yeah. This seemed to start with a person and tried to find a crime.
Yeah, I was very sympathetic to the president at that point in time. I used to tell Newt Gingrich and these guys, what are you all doing? You're crazy. Of course, he's ended up being one of the more popular presidents and probably one of the most effective.
Especially after he left office.
Yeah.
He skyrided.
Yeah.
And of course, the relationship with Bill Clinton came around full circle, because you had won your appeal, but it wasn't, it basically was going to send it back for a retrial.
Well, they hadn't made their mind up to do that, mm-hmm. but there certainly was a chance that they might do that. Mm-hmm. And so he issued what's called a preemptive pardon.
Of which I understand there have been three in American history.
That's right. It's really interesting. Yeah, they're
preemptive, meaning that you're not convicted of anything because the conviction had been vacated.
Yeah.
And it was Richard Nixon.
Ford Nixon. Then Caspar Weinberger was pardoned by Reagan. Isn't that right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. And then me. You know,
pretty good company.
Yeah. I'm certainly happy that it happened.
We will be back in just a few minutes. Governor Fife Symington, the entire hour on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are in the Think Tank with Arizona Governor Fife Symington. And I want to take us forward in this last section to more of the current day. Your thoughts on the current state of the Republican Party, both in the state and the nation as a whole?
Well, I'm heartened by at the presidential level, by the quality of the candidates that are running for president. I mean, I think we have some really great people, and even Trump is an addition, because he's just a walking media machine, and he's helping to attract attention.
Absolutely,
to not only himself, but to, you know, all the other people who are running, so that people are the American public, the voting public, is really getting to a good look and paying attention early, mm-hmm. as to, you know, who the Republicans may put up. And I think that's really great. As for the party here in the state, I haven't really been closely involved in, you know, what's been going on here, other than the fact that I've always supported John McCain. And he of course, is running for re-election in the Senate. And I think we would be absolutely nuts as a state to not re-elect him. I mean, if we ever needed a guy with his military background and life experiences as the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, helping to protect this country, the time is now, and John McCain is just essential to our national security, the way I look at it.
Well, if we hearken back, though, just a few years, in 2006, you lost a bid to become the Republican chair of the legislative district, which seems to me, as a former governor, that probably says more about the party than it says about you.
Well, I don't know. I think it says a lot about former governors. You know, Lamar Alexander, who's currently a U.S. senator, when we were governors together, he used to say, Fife, just remember this. He says, when you're a governor, you're a rooster today and you're a feather duster tomorrow.
We were talking earlier about interesting folks that have crossed your path. One of the more interesting current one is you have been a supporter of Ruben Gallego.
Oh, he's a great guy.
He's a Democrat, though.
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't done.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not driven totally by party. If I see an individual that I think has really unique leadership qualities and is something special, I'll reach out and support him. You know, Ruben's a Harvard grad. He's just a very bright guy. He's a war veteran, served his country. Has a very interesting background, has a lovely wife, and yeah, he's a Democrat, but you know, if we're going to be served well in Washington, we need people like that. And so I was very happy to support him in his primary, and I'm glad he's a congressman.
And I suppose the other thing, that in terms of the partisan aspect of that, no Republicans ever getting elected from that district anyway. So you're hardly giving up a seat.
Well, that's true. But then again, you never know. I mean, there are stories of sort of miraculous happenings like that when the registration's against you and Republicans run.
Usually they're one-off. Sam Coppersmith wins one term and then realizes that's a very short-term deal.
Well, Colby in Southern Arizona, you know, was a
swing seat.
Yeah, but it's pretty strongly Democratic community. But I really like Ruben. I think he's going to be quite a force, and we're friends, and I really respect him.
Yeah, well, he's
I don't agree with him on everything politically, but that doesn't mean you can't be friends. And there are some areas where we have common view.
You know, I think that may be an old school view that a lot of people aren't buying into now, that you can actually have a relationship with somebody on the other side of the aisle. You can actually disagree but be amicable in the disagreement.
Yeah, it's too bad. There needs to be more of that. We probably have a better time of it in Washington and even locally if we all were a little bit more friendlier towards each other and respectful of each other's views.
Dennis DeConcini was in here, and he said he thought that a lot of the reason had to do with the demise of earmarks, that earmarks was often the grease that got people to work together. And well, that's a dirty word. That was an astounding statement. But
yeah, you know, he may well be right. But the other argument about what's happening to the deficit and earmarks were kind of part of that, got swept into that. You know, not having strict budgetary controls and slowly but surely eroding the dollar by, what do we have, a $17-18 trillion deficit now that nobody could ever pay off. And you kind of wonder where all this is going to end. But Dennis probably has a very good point. That's just been the nature of the system, that you help me, I help you, and that got taken away.
It's a comment, of course, that's easier to be made by a retired politician than a current one, because it's endorsing
safer. Yeah.
You spent most of your career in private business before going into public life. I want to ask you about the question about this sort of phrase, I want to run government like a business, which has a lot, the people like to hear that, but do you really think you can?
Not across the boards. I mean, the whole decision-making process, if you're an entrepreneur and you have your own business, you really call the shots. You can make what I call straight-line decision-making, and you can do it quickly and decisively. When you're a governor, your business training certainly helps you in terms of your management skills, ability to organize, to recruit good people, and all those types of things, budgeting and whatnot. But the decision-making process is a whole new world. I mean, you're operating in a multidimensional world. Every single issue has a political constituency of at least one group, if not 15, and you have to really work to build consensus because you don't have a lot of power as governor. It's the ability to move your agenda through discussion and debate and influencing legislators and various groups that are, you know, make their living off of supporting a particular program. So it's a much more difficult environment than a business environment.
I've always thought in one sense, a business is simple. If you can develop a product or service and have it be either better or cheaper than something else, doing that is not necessarily easy, but the how you get there is relatively straightforward. In government, half the time you're trying to figure out what the objectives are.
Well, yeah, but not only that, too, is the mindset that if you're really sort of hardcore business and hard-headed and tone-deaf, you're going to have a lot of trouble in the political environment or being governor, because you have to be very flexible. You've really got to be able to listen and find out from a lot of people, their opinions about a particular issue, and you've got to chart a very careful course to be able to achieve a reform or whatever your objective is.
I remember seeing an interview with the chairman of PepsiCo who compared business to government and said, all of my board of directors wants me to succeed. The president works with an ineffective board of directors, the Congress, half of whom wants him to fail.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, the legislature has a great deal of power in the state, and if you're the governor, it's best to make friends with the legislative leadership and to work with them, because it's otherwise you end up with a very kind of contentious governance, and that's not much fun and won't accomplish a great deal.
One other thing, and real quickly on this one, procurement in government. I think you run a private business, somebody does a great job for you, you hire them again. Mm-hmm. In government, you may have to go through a whole start from scratch procurement process. Maybe difficult to.
Yeah, it's very complex, and through the Department of Administration, it's quite a daunting process to go through a procurement to get a contract.
Real quick, we've got about 30 seconds or so. Tell us about the UFO sighting.
Oh well, it happened not far from here. It was at the Squaw Peak where the whatever it was came over, and it was quite something. And I guess I'm in good company. I finally had to fess up about it. But I've always believed that, we're not alone in the universe. And someday we'll know that for a fact.
You probably didn't feel comfortable saying that when you're in public office, though.
No, because you become the object of severe ridicule.
Sure.
And but I think less so now. It's interesting. Yeah. I think the topic is people are a lot more open.
That's why
to
my
it.
Favorite guests are former politicians rather than current ones.
Yeah.
thank you very much, Fife Symington.
Thank you, Mike.
Former governor of Arizona. We're here on the Think Tank.